Good afternoon, everybody.
Please be seated. This is case number 58365, Citizens Outreach versus Clark County. This case we set here at Clark County, convenes the lawyers. I'm glad to do that, and set a expedited hearing in this matter. Mr. Parker, you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am, Justice Chair.
We're ready.
Let me say again, good afternoon, Justices. I would like to reserve 9 minutes for my rebuttal, since I'm facing two attorneys for this bond.
Okay.
If I can see, may it please the court. I think the issue we have today is one where there's some confusion at the district court level as to the standard to apply for the use of PLAs in the state of Nevada. Judge Weiss was clear in his amended order. Hopefully the justices have been provided with that amended order. But in particular, paragraph 4 and paragraph 5 of the amended order demonstrates Judge Weiss's confusion. He indicates that he denied the TRO because the PLA seemed to be similar in language to the PLA used and approved by the court in the 1999 ABC versus Southern Nevada Water Authority case. Now, what's a little odd about the decision was that the court, Judge Weiss, was never provided with a copy of that PLA, but he based his decision on the similarities as expressed by the respondents in their moving papers. And so if you go to paragraph 4 and to paragraph 5, the judge indicates that he felt compelled to deny the TRO despite the fact that he believed that there was irreparable harm that plaintiffs would suffer and that there were no compensatory damages that would be adequate to remedy the harm he foresaw. So now we get to what is the standard. And I believe the Southern Nevada Water Authority Court indicated fairly clearly what the standard was. And the standard is that PLAs will only be upheld in the state of Nevada if adopted in conformity with the Nevada competitive bidding statutes. The respondents are asking this court to adopt a different standard. The respondents are asking the court to adopt a standard where it determines that the PLA meets the purpose generally of the Nevada bidding statute. That's not what was pronounced in the Southern Nevada Water Authority case in 1999. There's no general compliance or general consistent standard. It must be adopted in conformity to what the Southern Nevada Water Authority case said. Now, in considering the PLA before the Southern Nevada Water Authority Court, the justices considered the fair of strikes, because there were two strikes that had just occurred that was within the record developed, and that's another point that has to be considered. Is the record sufficient to demonstrate whether or not the requirements of the Nevada competitive bidding statutes have been complied with? In that case, the court looked at the fair of strikes, the inability or the unavailability of skilled craftsmen, and the cost of having to go through any delays in the completion of that project. They were looking for on-time and on-budget completion. Those were the overwhelming concerns the court was faced then. Now, the record that we have in this case, is that the Vero Dana report, this is the only record we have which is being used by Clark County to support its position on the PLA. The Vero Dana report indicates that there is no fear of work stoppages. There's no fear of strikes. There's no fear of having a lack of skilled craftsmen. There's no fear or guarantee that using a PLA will create an on-time or on-budget completion. So all of the factors utilized by the Southern Nevada Water Authority Court in deciding that a PLA could be used, none of those factors exist today in these economic times. Now, I'm not using our own research. This is a research done within a month's time by Clark County. If you simply read the Vero Dana report, it says on its face This is not the type of project that would support a PLA. It says that. It says that we are not confronted with the same types of issues relative to work stoppages, strikes, that we had in 1996 when the Southern Nevada Water Authority chose to utilize a PLA. None of those things are present here. Now, the research that we did support our position with indicates that, in fact, PLAs drive up the cost to public owners. PLAs result in many non-union contractors, both general and subs, deciding not to bid on projects because they use their own employees. They can only use them to a certain number. Then once they reach that quantity of their own employees, they have to use employees from a union hall. Now, that drives up costs. First, they're obligated to pay the union benefits. But secondarily, they have to pay, in addition to their union benefits, their own retirement and health care benefits. So they're unfortunately confronted with this dual obligation, which again is confirmed in the Vero-Dana report. Additionally, when you're only able to use your own employees, up to 7 employees, your ability to be efficient, your ability to know what work can be done within a certain period of time because you've worked with these employees for years, you can't rely on that any longer. You now have to use...
You have 9 minutes. Go ahead, you will finish your thought.
Of course. Then you're only allowed to use those that you bring from Union Hall, which of course will disrupt your own efficiency. And I likened it and compared it to me using my own firm. I know what my lawyers can do. I know what my paralegals can do. If I was asked to use 3 or 4 lawyers out of this gallery, I don't believe I could be as efficient. It will cost me more to handle those claims.
They might say the same thing about you, Mr. Parker. Mr. Parker, I have a question on this point.
I look behind me, Judge. I don't know what lawyers
have
behind
you. You best keep your back down. have you raised an argument in this case that the PLA being considered violates Nevada's right to work statute?
Your Honor, it was a part of our argument in that it's addressed by the research that we utilized, and it controverts the information within the Vero-Dana report.
The reason I raise that question is this, and I'm interested in both counsel commenting on this. In the Associated Builders Contractors case in 1999, the court concluded at that time that under Bonito, that contract violated Nevada's right to work statute. But in examining the PLA in that case, it concluded that, quoting, further, non-union contractors may use up to 7 of their core employees selected on a one-to-one basis with employees referred by the union. And then it quoted the PLA as permitting or saying no employee covered by this agreement shall be required to join any union or pay any agency fees or dues. Those two provisions seem to me to be internally inconsistent.
I agree, Your Honor.
And if they are, does the provision in a PLA that says on the one hand you can establish ratios where 7 can be non-union, the rest must be union, but not require people to join union halls or pay dues are inconsistent, and therefore the rationale for not violating the right to work statute has not been satisfied?
Your Honor, your remarks are almost identical to Professor Turk. That's one of the studies that we provided as a part of our appendix, and he said exactly the same. When you require a contractor to use employees from union halls, then how are you not disadvantaging that contractor? How are you not driving up that cost? And how are you not, to the detriment of all non-union employees, keeping this on a level playing field? I mean, it's very easy to consider. If you have 10 core employees that you would typically put on a particular public works project, but you're limited to 7, and you have to bring in 3 Union Hall employees for those positions, how can you continue to be as competitive as everyone else? And why?
Well, actually, my
those...
question's a little bit different than that.
Right.
If you're limited, if your job requires 10 and you can only use 7, then aren't you requiring 3 to pay dues and be a member?
You're,
and is that not in violation of the right to work statute?
The way this PLA is set up, it claims that they do not, the people brought through the union halls don't have to join the union, but the employer is still paying the union benefits. So whether or not they join, we're still paying those benefits for which we receive no, the company received no benefits. And we're paying our own benefits. And so you, what you're doing is you're encouraging us to lay off or not hire non-union people. So we won't have to pay that dual benefit, which again discriminates against the 85% non-union workforce in this state. So it's consistent with this, what Your Honor is saying.
Mr. Parker, you have 4 minutes and 22 seconds left. I'm going to give you an extra 4 minutes, which means you'll have 8 minutes and 22 seconds, and I'm going to give the respondents an additional 4 minutes. So you'll have 19 minutes to divide up your sides. Ms. Nielsen, will you go first? If Hank, if you could make sure that we have 19 minutes for this side. And Mr. Parker, you'll have an additional, you'll have 8 minutes total for your rebuttal.
Thank you very much,
Ms. Nielsen, on behalf of Clark County.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Leslie Nielsen on behalf of Clark County. May I just take care of the one housekeeping matter of from which order has have appellants appealed. As you're probably aware, the district court entered its order on May 27th. Notice of entry was given, and the notice of appeal, an amended notice of appeal was filed on May 31st. And once that amended notice of appeal was filed on May 31st, I would argue that the district court was divested of jurisdiction to continue entering amended orders.
So you're saying the June 1st order we can't consider?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that that's the simplest way to handle it so that there's no confusion. I actually would be happy to argue from either order because I think in either event the judge applied the correct standard and reached the correct result. But I think it's pretty clear that the district court did not have jurisdiction to enter an amended order after the notice of appeal was filed on May, amended notice of appeal was filed on May 1st. Counsel for Building and Construction Trades Council and I have discussed the potential for responding to various questions. And so just briefly, with respect to your question, Justice Hardesty, in terms of the right to work provisions, it's correct that there is provision in the project labor agreement that contemplates using 7 core employees for non-union contractors. And the Nevada Supreme Court, obviously, in the SMWA case, found that that was not violative of the right to work statute and that. And may I also point out that counsel has argued that the non-union contractors don't bid on these projects, but we've established and we've shown in the papers that that's not true. I think it's important for me to go back over the facts because they are really important in this context.
Well, I hope I'll just restate my question.
Yes,
maybe
please do.
My point has been lost in all of this, but my question is whether the court's analysis of the right to work statute in that previous case is incorrect because of the corresponding provision, which I understand exists in this PLA also, that you do not require the payment of dues or other membership obligations by the employees to be members of a union, right?
Your Honor, when I read the SMWA case and citation to prior Nevada Supreme Court cases and other cases, I didn't see that there was any inconsistency with respect to the right to work statute.
Is the am I correct that the PLA in this case has the same two provisions that are contained in that case, that on the one hand, the contractor can have seven non-union core working employees, but also no one is required to pay membership dues or be a member of a union?
That's correct. The facts in our case are really important to understand the application of the SNWA case, because we believe that our facts are just directly on point, and that, in fact, we actually feel like we have a stronger case in adopting the project labor agreement here. Recognizing that the North Tower had exceeded its life expectancy, the county hired JMA Architecture in 2009 to evaluate the extent of deterioration in the building systems and then to develop a plan and a budget for necessary repairs. So while the evaluation was underway last year, we had two condenser water lines that failed, causing an emergency declaration, and we had to replace those. So the county had been undertaking repairs along the way, and in the meantime, though, the report concluded that the plumbing systems were in a severe state of deterioration with cracked, blocked, and collapsed piping. And based on the report, we prepared a multi-phased renovation program to address the most critical repairs first. So total estimated construction costs of all phases is $106 million. The first phase is the phase that is at issue here, and this project labor agreement would apply to the first phase. And it contemplates closing down the kitchen and the laundry, shutting them down, removing or replacing them, and that this phase one is expected to cost about $27 million. There is potential for catastrophic plumbing failure in the North Tower, and it would require the emergency evacuation of between 1,600 and 1,700.
Where would those prisoners go if they had to be evacuated?
The emergency plans contemplate sending about 1,080 of them to the North Valley Complex or the low-level offender facility in North Las Vegas, and then many of the others might perhaps could be accommodated in other detention centers under our mutual aid agreements. But the concern, of course, is that some would have to be released back into the community. So the project is critical, and the county decided to use a design-build delivery method in order to expedite the project and allow for the overlapping of both design and the construction phases at the same time. So last December, the county advertised the initial request for proposals without any mention of the project labor agreement, and we received proposals from 12 design-build teams. Then during the February 1st meeting, when the project labor agreement was first considered by our commission, one commissioner noted that it was very big concern that if there was ever a project on which work stoppage could not be tolerated, it would be a detention center project because it would be such a logistical nightmare to have inmates in a jail and a delayed project. County staff advised the commission at that time that in order to satisfy the requirements of the SNWA case and Nevada Supreme Court case that obviously we believe was right on point, that we would have to hire an expert and to have a study performed to determine whether the adoption of a project labor agreement on this project would satisfy the competitive bidding statutes and the SNWA case.
Ms. Nielsen, can I go back to the safety issue for a second? Was there anything presented in the district court as to the ratio of prisoners in the Clark County Detention Center between violent and nonviolent offenders? Do we know roughly what that is?
I don't know that, but I understand most of the inmates in the North Tower are violent offenders, and so there is a concern also with respect to losing the other facilities, medical facilities, and special housing for mentally ill inmates. It's a real problem because we have classification issues, and it's very difficult to house them in other locations. So based on the advice that council provided to the board at the February 1st meeting, the commission then hired an expert. That's the Vero Dana study that you've heard about, to analyze the proposed use and legality of the PLA on this project. So then the commission also authorized the re-advertisement of the project with the notice that a project labor agreement might be required on the project, and then also direction to staff to begin negotiations of a project labor agreement pending a receipt of the study's conclusion. So when the project was re-advertised, the county received 13 proposals that included the same 12 plus one additional proposal. And then at the February 15th meeting, when the board took this up again, the commission chair expressed concern about the precarious condition of the building systems. And so everybody was concerned that this project proceed expeditiously. County staff then received a report from Darrell Dana on March 11th and circulated it to the commission. They concluded that under the current economic and labor climate in Las Vegas, that the proposed use of the project labor agreement would be legal and conform to the objectives of our competitive bidding laws. And so to the extent that appellant's counsel suggests that the Darrell Dana study does not support the adoption of a project labor agreement in this case, that's not true. The Darrell Dana study concluded that the proposed use is legal and does conform to the competitive bidding laws. It does mention that there is that the supply of workers is plentiful in this economic climate, and in some cases, if there is a shortage, it would help justify a project labor agreement to help with skilled craftsmen, but I think that it would just be a secondary concern and not something that, and I think the Nevada Supreme Court did not find it important that there was a labor shortage to justify the project labor agreement. The Verrill study did point out the threat of jurisdictional.
Well, wasn't it important to the decision that Ms. Mulroy had identified two work stoppages that had occurred in the other water project that formed a basis for the PLA in that case? Here your expert seems to be saying they're not concerned about availability of workforce to cause a work stoppage.
Well, now, Justice Hardesty, we're talking about two different things. Uh-huh. You know, the shortage of craftsmen versus the potential for labor for work stoppages,
mm-hmm.
and strikes or lockouts or other, other work stoppages. So, yes, it's true that Ms. Mulroy was concerned about the potential for strikes because there had been two prior strikes on Colorado River Commission projects. But as we've pointed out, there also have been strikes in this valley in recent times. Our county staff's aware of a one-day work stoppage on the Metro headquarters just weeks before this case was filed. And, of course, according to the Darren Enns affidavit that's in the record, and as generally is known in this area, we have suffered through larger strikes in terms of the City Center project and the Cosmopolitan project, where 9,000 workers were on strike. So we can't promise. I mean, without a project labor agreement, obviously there's no guarantee there's going to be a strike, but there's no case. The case law does not require that we are certain of an impending strike. The key terms in our project labor agreement are the same as those in the SNWA case, and I'm not real clear on the concern about the similarity of language standard that was apparently, or that counsel suggests was applied by the district court, but I believe that it is important that our project labor agreement does track the project labor agreement that is clear from the actual reported Nevada Supreme Court decision. So we know what provisions this court found were important, and we were certain to make sure that those provisions were also included in this project labor agreement. So that is, no employee is required to join a union or pay union dues. Both union and non-union contractors and subcontractors have equal access to the project. Non-union contractors can use up to 7 employees, as discussed before. There's non-discriminatory operation of the union referral procedures. No strike provisions enforced by the liquidated damages provision to deter any work stoppage. We have speedy dispute resolution procedures that's applicable to all trades. And another very important point is that according to the project labor agreement, workers need not be paid more than the prevailing wage. So it's suggested that we have to pay in excess of the prevailing wage under NRS Chapter 338. Prevailing wage is defined to include both wages and benefits, and so there isn't any obligation, according to this project labor agreement, to pay in excess of the prevailing wage.
So you're saying, Mr. Parker was saying that his clients would have to pay benefits that they normally pay plus all the union benefits as well. You're saying that's not necessary to do that?
It would not be necessary to do that. That's correct. There isn't any evidence in the record, may I point out, that, well, of course, as I will be pointing out in a moment, we have just as members of the appellant's trade association, we don't really even know who those subcontractors are, and there's no evidence in the record that any of them are paying dual benefits, and co-counsel will help will address that issue.
But you're saying your interpretation of the PLA does not require a non-union contractor to pay dual benefits.
It does not require the payment of dual benefits. Instead, it requires the payment of prevailing wage, and under Chapter 338.010, subparagraph 21 and 035, to pay prevailing wage means to pay wages and benefits. So they're subsumed into one. So the payment into a union fund is that there isn't any obligation to pay in excess of the prevailing wage. If prevailing wage is $50 an hour and benefits are 10, then the wage would be the difference, 40.
And the non-union contractor can satisfy the benefit requirement by showing that they're paying prevailing benefits, not necessarily to the union, but in some other form.
No, the project labor agreement requires that the benefits be paid into the union fund. Mm-hmm.
There's about 3 minutes and a half left. Do you want to give co-counsel a chance?
So, we want to point out that we have never found out who the members of these trade associations are. We have, they're anonymous members. We believe they're subcontractors based on statements made in argument. The affidavits don't make clear that they have a direct interest in this litigation. The burden, obviously, is for the appellants to show that they have standing, but they're anonymous. We don't have any ability to determine who they are. So we just want to point out that the SNWA case, we feel like we're squarely within the SNWA case by adopting the project labor agreement here, and we feel like we have actually a stronger argument for the project labor agreement than in that SNWA case, because this is a design-build project, and so only 30% weight is assigned to cost versus 100% in the SMWA case. And so when we're considering the applicable competitive bidding law, we should be looking to 338.1723 rather than Section 147, which requires the lowest bid. We have evidence that the project labor agreement will not reduce competition because we had 12 proposals before the project labor agreement was contemplated and 13 after. Pat Mulroy was not sure how the two strikes on the Colorado River Commission project affected the project schedules, but here we have Chief Dixon, Ms. Carter, the commissioners, and Captain Donahue all describing how the delays could affect this detention center project. Similarly, in the SMWA case, there was no specific discussion in the record about saving public funds, but the court presumed that labor strikes could affect public funds. So the bigger concern was to complete the projects on time to ensure that there would be an adequate water supply. In our case, we have between 15 and 30 different trades working inside an occupied and a functioning jail. These are different, and we believe difficult constraints that were not faced by the SMWA case. They are two critical projects. In the case of the SMWA project, they were concerned about shortage of water supply, which I believe is much like our concern about the shortage of jail space. So careful reading of the case indicates that the appellants were not likely to succeed on the merits, and the district court did not abuse its discretion, and of course we believe the relative hardship favors the county. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Moore, I'm going to give you a total of 3 minutes, and Mr. Parker, you've just increased your now to about 10 minutes.
Thank you very much.
This is an important issue to all of us, so we want to make sure that we give everybody a chance. So you'll have a total of 3 minutes, and then Mr. Parker will have 10 minutes of rebuttal.
May it please the Court, Paul Moore with McCracken, Stemmerman, Holsberry here on behalf of Intervenor Southern Nevada Building and Construction Trades Council. Let me first turn to the question that Justice Hardesty raised concerning the right to work statute in Nevada. First of all, that issue was not raised below. It has not been briefed. It was not part of the district court's order. But I'll address it briefly in any case. Although in
that was my threshold question. Was it a basis for relief in the district court? If the answer is no, then don't waste your time.
It was not, Your Honor, and it was not part of the order. Let me address a couple of other points quickly. First, the question of labor disputes, which is really at the crux of project labor agreements. There's indication and a statement in a plaintiff's brief that there might be other ways of preventing the labor unions that will inevitably be working on this type of project from striking or engaging in workplace disputes. That is incorrect. Our clients, labor unions, have a federally protected right to strike, to picket. And so a project labor agreement, which is a negotiated contract between those unions and the county, in which both sides give up certain rights, is the only way to ensure that on a project like this, there are not labor disputes that lead to delays, that lead to potentially prison release orders. So I want to get that point out initially. It's also extremely curious that plaintiff's counsel states that the Verrill-Dana study did not see labor disputes as an issue. I don't see how you can read that study and not come to the exact opposite conclusion. In fact, that study points out that during a recession like this one is exactly when that danger is most potent. One of the reasons is because every job that is out there is hotly contested. So disputes between unions over whose craft jurisdiction should get that particular work increase during recessions like this one. Disputes between union and non-union contractors, including picketing of non-union contractors, increase. And that was the basis for the Verrill-Dana study's conclusion that a PLA was appropriate on this project. I'll say a few words also about this issue of the so-called dual benefits. There is no evidence in the record that any contractor faces this problem. And in fact, if you look in the record at the two affidavits that were submitted by ABC executives, Daniel Burdish and Clara Andriola, and that's at page 756 of the record, neither of them even mentions this issue. The Verrill-Dana study, and I'll just conclude with this point, the Verrill-Dana study says, as a theoretical issue, this might come up. There might be some contractor out there that has benefit plans that it can't cease payments into while its employees are working on this project and paying into joint labor management funds. But any effect there is going to be highly tangential to the ultimate question here, which is, are contractors being dissuaded from bidding on this project? And of course, the overwhelming evidence, actual evidence, on this project as well as on the Southern Nevada Water Authority project is that the existence of a PLA does not lead to the decrease in bidders, it does not lead to a decrease in the number of union bidders, and it does not lead to an increase in costs.
Mr. Parker, 10 minutes and rebuttal.
Well, let me start out by questioning whether or not we're all working from the same Southern Nevada Water Authority case. Page 5 of this case indicates that the court said that we're concerned, as was the Southern Nevada Water Authority, with the prospect of labor strikes. We were concerned and learned of two strikes that occurred on a water project which was contemporaneous with the consideration of the Southern Nevada Water Authority deliberating over the PLA. That's something that these your justices have already commented on, but for some reason is ignored by Clark County and the Building Trades Council. In fact, on page 160 of the holding here, of the decision, it says an obvious concern in adopting the PLA was the cost of delay and the considerations of saving public funds. We hold that the PLA at issue was adopted in conformity with Nevada competitive bidding laws. And it reports back to the record in two occasions. It says it at page 159, according to the record, providing equal access to projects to both union and non-union at no disadvantage to non-union contractors is an issue of concern. Further, the record indicates that the PLA was considered due to concerns about potential labor disputes and a halt to the project after the Water Authority learned of two strikes that had occurred on the project. The next sentence reads, although the record does indicate specific discussion about saving public funds, labor strikes are an issue which could affect public funds. That's the record that was developed in that case after 15 months of studies by the expert retained by the Southern Nevada Water Authority. What happened in this case was that the Clark County Board of Commission decided to use a PLA, instructed its staff to begin working and negotiating the PLA, and then, in fact, determined on its February 1st board meeting that we're going to delay this project 2 or 3 months to let these discussions go forward between the unions and its staff. That doesn't sound like an authority concerned about getting the project done. And in fact, during its March 15th meeting, it decided to go forward with the PLA, and it hadn't even read yet the actual study by Verrill Dana. Within the record, we provided the minutes of the March 15th meeting, and there one of the commissioners indicates that we just received this and the majority of the people at the Diaz had not read or even had it within their possession the actual report, but they approved it going forward. That's as of March 15th. The report, as you can see, is dated March 11th. Now, you go to the report, and again, perhaps we're working from a different report, but the Verrill Dana reports, just to start off with the dual obligation issue, says at page 17, with a PLA, non-union contractors that maintain one or more company-provided benefit plans confront the possibility that PLA may require them to contribute to the union plans pursuant to the PLA. That's what we have here, and that's exactly what was just brought out through the questioning of Justice Hardesty. These non-union contractors will be putting into a fund for union benefits that their non-union employees will never see the benefit of. And on top of that, paying their own benefits within their company, their health plans, their retirement plans. That's the dual obligation that this Verrill Dana report indicates. And when we talk about strikes, this is something I also find odd. We're talking about preventing strikes that would delay projects. So Ms. Nielsen indicated that we've had strikes recently in the Cosmopolitan and in City Center. Those were under the stewardship of a general contractor that was union, not a non-union contractor. 85% of the contractors in Nevada are non-union. What else is remarkable is that only union contractors strike. Only union employees strike. You don't have strikes by non-union companies and non-union employees. So do we reward the striking companies, the 15%, by giving them this advantaged position through a PLA? only under certain circumstances. This is not a mechanical standard that was created in 1999 where you just, okay, this is the language from this PLA. As long as we use it, no matter what the circumstances are, it will be confirmed by the district court and then validated further by the Supreme Court. That's not what that court decided. It considered the facts. It considered the circumstances, and it made its decision based on concerns actually discussed and developed in the record. And it pointed to the record. It's not some mechanical application that anyone, a fifth grader, can do. I can see that the PLAs are the same, so it must be valid. That's not what was done, and that's not what the court instructed district courts to do henceforth from 1999. Now, one thing, the Verrodano report also says that court extensions of PLAs originally negotiated in 1996 through 2001 time period, virtually no new PLAs have been signed in Las Vegas for major project work in the last decade. That's page 7 of the Verrodano report. This report is replete with portions of the record that supports not going forward with this PLA. It indicates here that, and in fact, the Verrodano report indicates that Clark County has the burden of proof to demonstrate through this record that it's considered these factors and that the adoption of the PLA is in conformity with Southern Nevada Water Authority holding. And it says here, which, and that burden, of course, is pronounced twice in this report on page 3 and page 12. And it says the authority bears the burden of showing that the decision to enter into the PLA has at its purpose the advancement of the interests embodied in the competitive bidding statutes. It recognizes the obligation of the public authority. Now, when we get to whether or not there's a likelihood of strikes, the Verrodano report does comment on it, but it says from union contractors, not non-union contractors. Now, what it does to dissuade contractors from striking or employees from striking is it places the burden on the signatories to the PLA, subcontractors as well as general contractors, a liquidated damage provision. Those aren't new or unique to projects with PLAs. In fact, the original detention center was done without a PLA. That's done every day of the week. I litigate those cases every day of the week. LDs will dissuade anyone. And in this case, there's a $10,000 liquidated damage provision. That's the stick to ensure that union and non-union contractors complete on time this project. It doesn't require a PLA. The other suggestions, I think, are just as weak. We have performance bonds and payment bonds in public works projects over $100,000. Those ensure completion and payment, union or non-union. These are simply bid specifications that can be handled without a PLA, and they're done every day without a PLA. Now, in the Verrodano report, it mentions here, page 14, that the court focused on finding evidence of the Water Authority's concern for protecting public funds and to quantify the savings it expected. There's nothing in this record suggesting that any of that was done. This Verrodano report was put together in less than a month. It was approved without even seeing it. And then it was finally signed after April 19th, the day after we had the hearing, regarding the rightness of the motion. That's how this was done, as opposed to the 15 months it took to actually perform the study for the Southern Nevada Water Authority case. The Verrodano report also says there is no guarantee of an on-time and on-budget performance to be given by a PLA. So Clark County gets up and says these are the reasons why, but they've done no study in this. They've done no study that supports it, but the study that they have done is replete with reasons why you shouldn't use a PLA. Finally, Verrodano says on page 24 that this is a qualified opinion that it satisfies the requirements, and it says We resolved this very this close question in favor of recommending a properly structured agreement as a bid specification. That's what the report says, Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Parker, Ms. Nielsen, Mr. Moore, for your excellent arguments. This matter will stand submitted. Thank you very much, everybody. We'll be in recess until my panel will meet tomorrow at 10 o'clock.
Thank you.